symphony. What a wealth of images and impressions and memories that word conjures up. Literally, it means sounds coming together, or sounds that have come together, that have been wedded, assembled by someone with skill and fantasy, brain and heart, to become something greater, something more than the sum of their parts. What a generously roomy building the symphony is. It accommodates that exquisite jewel, the 9-minute symphony of the early 20th century Viennese composer Anton Webern, music in which every breath, every dab of color, every silence has been minutely weighed and considered. And it also provides space for, well, I don't even know what the most elephantine and unruly symphony is. Maybe one by Havergal Brian, that strange English visionary and composer of 32 such mammoths. And here is Beethoven, who can make us believe that he personally invented triumph. Triumph wrested from darkness and struggle. That he invented joy and unbridled physical exuberance. Certainly no one before him translated those experiences and feelings in sound so vividly, so irresistibly. Definitely not in purely instrumental music. For that matter, has anyone managed it since? But here we also have Tchaikovsky, sinking in the last pages he put down on paper into a place of despair so dark that no one can find him and nothing can comfort him. Gustav Mahler also knows such abysses. But in his music, pain is hardly ever abstracted or isolated. Rather, it lives together with joy and, much more disconcertingly, with the inconsequential, the ordinary. Aristotle, the apostle of order in art and of neatly maintained pigeonholes, would despise the inspired, beautiful, and painfully lifelike disorder of Mahler's music. A deeply Mahler-loving conductor I know once likened it to someone wanting to tell you all about his vacation in Italy, but at the crucial moment, dropping the whole box of slides on the floor. For me, Mahler always brings to mind the poem Musée des Beaux-Arts in which Auden observes how unflinchingly the old masters understood that suffering takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. But are Mozart and Schubert and Brahms, sufferers all, less disconcerting? Well, yes, but only because unlike Mahler, who grabs your lapels and yells in your face and cries in your beer, who doesn't allow you to withdraw your attention from his personal seismograph for one moment, they are, in their very different ways and different languages, artists who believe in decorum, who believe that their pain, their places that are tender as a wound is tender, that these are things for you to discover as a reward for long and patient and deeply attentive listening. What a moment it is in the life of everyone who loves music, when suddenly you sit in shock, realizing the agony, the roiling beneath Mozart's exquisite good manners, imperturbable for all but a few seconds in the finale of the G minor symphony. And how much joy and happiness and ecstasy we can find in the endlessly generous world of symphony. There's Haydn, the first composer to give us great symphonies, and so many of them. He was lucky, Haydn was, working 30 years in the Hungarian countryside for the Esterházy family. He had an excellent orchestra at his disposal, an employer who wanted him to do what he wanted to do, plus the gift of isolation, of studying, experimenting, working with no professional rivalries or anxieties to distract him. And when his time with the Esterházys came to an end and he went to London, he found an ideal audience there, one prepared to follow his endlessly inventive mind on every one of its marvelously unexpected voyages. And, of course, giddily delighted to be made to feel as intelligent and as witty as the composer himself. It was wonderful for Haydn, but we're all the beneficiaries of those happy circumstances. Haydn set the standard for symphonies, and to this day we have not had, and I shouldn't think we're likely to have, finer symphonies than the ones Haydn composed for his adoring Londoners in the 1790s. Different, yes, but not finer. Grander. Working with a wider vocabulary of harmony, rhythm, color, and texture, and certainly more rhetorical and more overtly emotional. The tremendous expressive and emotional charge that the symphonies of Beethoven and those that came after him carry has to do with that expansion of vocabulary. But even more, it has to do with a change in design, in the distribution of weight. With Haydn and Mozart, the center of gravity is at the beginning, in an elaborate first movement that is perhaps almost matched by the slow movement, but the minuet and finale are on a smaller scale and lighter, which doesn't keep them from being wonderful. The composer John Harbison, a fine symphony writer himself, once remarked that it is possible to be left dry-eyed by a Mahler symphony but completely taken apart by a Haydn presto. But think of the Beethoven symphonies, the Eroica or the Fifth, or in its quiet way, the Pastoral, and especially the Ninth. For me, by the way, the Pastoral is forever my special love among the Beethoven symphonies. Perhaps it goes back to seeing Fantasia with its little fauns and bra-clad centaurettes when I was 11. In those Beethoven symphonies, the finale is not just that which comes last. It is the goal, the destination, the culmination of the entire work, that magic place toward which everything tends, the place where tensions are resolved and questions answered. When that happens, you can think of the symphony as narrative. The whole work is a story, one that begins with the first sound, perhaps even in the silence before the first sound, and which ends with the last. But I'd started to talk about happiness and joy, and so I travel from Haydn to Anton Bruckner, that man who never learned to manage this world, but who saw the next with such confidence and certainty. Handel is supposed to have said about composing the Hallelujah Chorus, "I thought I saw the heavens open and the great Lord himself." If ever there was a composer who could translate that feeling into instrumental music, it was Anton Bruckner. Oh, to have the minutes in which to sing the praises of the poetic Berlioz, of Schumann and Dvorak, of the surprising minor masters like Goldmark, Kalinikov, or Steinhammer, and of the eloquent and so diverse symphonists of our own century, Elgar, Sibelius, Ives, Rachmaninoff, Vaughan Williams, Nielsen, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Onegaer, Martinu, Franz Schmidt, Carl Amadeus Hartmann, Roger Sessions, Michael Tippett, and those keeping the faith in the infinite possibilities of the symphony today, Hans-Werner Henze, Eino Juhani Rautavaara, John Harbison, Christopher Rouse, and Aaron J. Kernes. When Kernes was writing his first symphony a few years ago, he remarked that he was surprised to find himself doing so. Let's hope that he and others will experience similar surprises and surprise us too. When we go to the symphony, we can be sure to find something of ourselves in what we hear, and with luck, something of what is best in us.